Okay, welcome back to part three. This is going to be very brief. We're going to talk about, answer the question, what is the solution? What is the solution to this interminable war being waged against Africans, which I'm just using the United States to highlight and characterize that war. That war's being waged many, many parts of the globe against African people. So two quotes and sayings. One, the only argument that satisfies man is power, which is by Frederick Douglass. Secondly, power is the ability to cause or prevent change, which is a quote by Rollo May. And the above two quotes pretty much sum up what it's all about. There's no appeal to morality or fellowship or the brotherhood or sisterhood of man or woman that's going to solve this problem. The only answer is to build a community that has the power to inflict economic damage upon those who target us. I mean, fundamentally, if you think about the world, the only nations in the world that are able to stand up to the United States are those who have economic clout and military clout. So, for example, China and Russia. Even North Korea, which doesn't have economic clout, but which has nuclear clout by way of nuclear weapons, the United States treads carefully in dealing with it. If it didn't have nuclear weapons, they would have invaded North Korea a long time ago. Now, in the United States, the possibility of a military solution is not really viable. So economic solution is the only answer. The ability to impact and economically squeeze those who wage in this unending war against us. And Dr. Claude Anderson, as I've mentioned many times, has described this extensively for us. So I don't need to go over all his suggestions, and obviously I've written extensively on these subjects as well, but I'll just remind you once again of his guidance to us on building a community and how you build it on five levels. So you can imagine it as a five-story building, and he describes it as level one, the foundation, is about building an economy. Once you have an economy, you have money and means and wealth creation, you can gain control of level two, or build level two, which is to gain control over the politicians. And remember, in the United States, it's the politicians who have control over the judicial system. It's the politicians who help to control the district attorneys, the chiefs of police, and these people who have control over the police force, which terrorizes Africans. And it's all levered through money, campaign donations, and all those kind of things. So he says, gain control over politicians. If you can't buy one, you lease one. If you can't lease one, you rent one. Level three, gain influence over the court system, the so-called criminal justice system, but it doesn't deserve the word justice within it. So gain control over the court system. And again, in the United States, that's easier because of their system of electing officials. And of course, people like district attorneys who at the moment don't prosecute these police officers and don't want to, with support of politicians, you gain control over those systems, particularly in areas which are majority African. You can control who gets appointed to those positions, who gets appointed to head the police, and ensure that those people prosecute these police officers. And once these police officers start to go to prison, once they start to lose their jobs, once they start to be deprived of their liberty, they'll think twice about murdering Africans. Level four, develop your own media. So you need a propaganda arm, which is what the corporate media is at the moment campaigning to validate and to legitimize the murder of Africans. We need our own media that can be used to push the message that it's a crime to kill Africans and to propagandize on our own behalf. And level five is education, which Africans normally build the building upside down and think that education is the start. Education is the icing on the cake. So as we're building a house, you concentrate on laying strong foundations, i.e. an economy, and you build upwards from there. And that's, of course, why I've developed blackfinancialfitness.com, which is part of my contribution to the process. Your job is to work out how you can contribute to our economic development wherever you live, and to share this message of economic empowerment as being fundamental to the changing of African people's circumstances and to change us from being everybody's footstool. Now, on a wider world basis, we will need to develop African countries that also have military clout as well, because push comes to shove, the United States will often turn to the military option as its leadership role for the so-called Western world, or more accurately, the European world. So African countries will have to develop that. But the first point of that is you need to have an economy first before you can build a really effective military, because bullets don't make themselves, guns don't make themselves, tanks don't make themselves, aircraft carriers don't make themselves. You need an economic base in order to produce these things. So that's the end of part three. Some food for thought. And when we come back, it'll be part four, which will be Brexit. Don't count your chickens. Okay, welcome back to part four. I hope you're still with me. Refilled the jug, got some food, ready for Brexit. Okay, so the votes are in, and I've been advised, asked, instructed, told in many ways that I should provide analysis of the aftermath and implications of the UK referendum result. In case you've been living under a rock, it was 52% for Brexit and 48% to remain. And the referendum was held on the 23rd of June. I voted for Brexit, only the second time I've ever voted in my life, as I indicated in the main newsletter. I'm not going to rehearse my reasons for doing so. You can go back and read the main newsletter if you're interested. But I didn't vote with any expectation that whether it was in or out, the world was suddenly going to change. There's far bigger issues around the whole issue of sovereignty and economic independence and Brexit, which I might touch on a little bit later, or may cover in more detail in another issue. But I just want to give you some background to some of the things that I found interesting about the whole analysis and coverage of the referendum vote. So, first issue is the general sentiment that it's the poor and uneducated what done it. So this was the sentiment in the British media. It's those poor, uneducated, racist, stupid people who've been going on Google to put in the question, what is the EU? What are the implications of leaving the EU after the referendum? That's been a sentiment that's been put forward. Now, for me, at present, I've got what you'd call a portfolio career. And that's to say, I don't have a job, but I earn money from a variety of different types of work. So this type of career gives me the opportunity to interact with a lot of highly educated, in the accredited sense, well-paid, mainly quote-unquote liberal individuals, most of whom are white. And what has been remarkably consistent has been, firstly, the utter shock and devastation of most of these people at the referendum result. Secondly, the barely concealed and sometimes openly stated assumptions about those people who voted for Brexit. And thirdly, the unquestioned assumption that I voted for Remain, which has really given me a quiet chuckle. So in terms of the second point, it was clear that the overwhelming majority of the people to whom I'm referring, to date I've only met three people who voted for Brexit in these type of settings, assumed that people who voted for Brexit were poor, uneducated, racist, fearful, and generally uninformed. Now, in order to allow these people to share their views openly, I've not disclosed to them that I voted Brexit, but rather I've listened carefully to the views of these what I call Remainers. And what is interesting is that none of them actually asked me how I voted. So strong was their assumption about the type of person who would support Brexit. And also the shocked reaction of this group of people to the result was really instructive. as it almost completely mirrored the reaction on the BBC and the corporate media, from whom many of my sample group had obviously obtained their pro-Remain talking points. And it also just goes to show the complete disconnect between the corporate media and large swathes of the British population. Because the EU has always been a political project masquerading as an economic project, and there's absolutely no need for much of its bureaucracy in order for nation states to trade with each other in a trading bloc. And it was also interesting, the geographical split as well, because London voted to remain strongly, about 60-40, and every other region of England voted to Brexit. Scotland voted, every region of Scotland voted to remain, whereas Wales voted to Brexit, and Northern Ireland also voted to remain. So let's look at this wider question as to whether Britain is really unique, as they've been suggesting. And when you actually look at the data, you'll actually see that anti-EU sentiment is actually spreading across Europe. I went to find some research from the Pew Research Centre. This is from spring 2016, and it's part of their Global Attitude Survey. And they asked a question about favourable views of the European Union. And they asked it in 7 countries. So here are the results. And this question has been followed sort of longitudinally over a period of time. So if we go back to 2004, we find that 54% of people in the UK had favourable views of the EU. And in 2016, that had fallen to only 44%. If we look at France, which is the most remarkable result, given that the EU was built around what they call the Franco-German alliance, we find in 2004, 69% of the French had a positive view of the EU, favourable view of the EU, and that's actually fallen to a remarkably low 38%, even lower than Britain in 2016. The Greek result only dates back to 2012, and even back then, because the Greeks were obviously being economically raped by the EU even back then, 37% of Greeks had a favourable view of the EU, and in 2016 that had fallen to 27%. And if we look at Germany, which is absolutely the heart of the EU, in 2004, 58% of Germans had a positive view of the EU, and in 2016, that was at 50%. Spain, again, is another stark example of how sentiments towards the EU have changed significantly. If we look at Spain, if I can follow the trajectory of this line correctly, we find that in just around, it looks to be just around 2007, 80% of the Spanish had a favourable view of the EU, and in 2016 that had fallen to 47%. So the most pro-EU country now is Poland, of the 7 they looked at, which was at 83% in 2007. That's fallen to 72%. So even in the countries that have majority citing positive views of the EU, we find that it's been falling steadily over time. And we find that the EU is quite unpopular in many of its member states. And just to pop this idea that it's just a left-right thing, that left-wing people are all pro-EU, right-wing people are against the EU, you actually find that changes in some countries. So, for example, in Sweden, more people who classify themselves as right-wing are in favour of the EU compared to those classified as left-wing, which is the opposite of, in, say, the UK. I don't classify myself as either. Okay, so if we then look at the Pew Research, they've got a view of European views of the EU and potential Brexit. This was before the referendum result came out. So you've got the UK leaving the European Union would be a Bad thing for the EU, 70%. A good thing for the EU, 60%, 16%. So most people, irrespective of their views, thought that the UK leaving would be bad for the EU, because I think most people realise that the UK leaving could lead to an unravelling of the EU, particularly given the strong anti-EU sentiment. So the reality is that the European Union elites are terrified of the British referendum result emboldening other populations across Europe. They're absolutely terrified. And they know that if there was referenda held in France and other countries, they would also leave the European Union. And that's why they're doing everything in their powers to ensure that that won't be allowed, that other people won't be allowed to express their views. Now, in terms of the process of actually leaving, we were told that the referendum in Britain was advisory. It's not legally binding, but David Cameron, before he stepped down as Prime Minister, had said he would honour the result of the referendum, whichever way it went. But we also know that there's plenty of people and politicians who are lobbying hard to have the referendum result put to one side. So firstly, in the aftermath of the referendum result, we had the ridiculous online petition organised by a Remain campaigner, which is calling for a second referendum, but this time with a provision that the result should only be binding if there was at least a 60% vote either way and a 75% turnout. The actual turnout was 72%. Now, the disingenuous and hypocritical nature of this petition is highlighted by the fact that very few of these people are now calling for a second referendum. We're making these calls before the first referendum result. And very few of them were seeking such stringent conditions prior to the first referendum, especially when there was a surge in the support for Remain in the polls following the murder of MP Joe Cox and the subsequent and not so subtle use of that sad event by the corporate media to push the Remain agenda. And also, you have to also remember that in the most recent UK parliamentary elections, which in the end were won where the Conservatives got a small majority based on about 40% of the total share of the vote, there was only a turnout of 62%. But nobody questions the legitimacy of the Conservative government, who got around 40% of the vote on a 62% turnout. So the test of a principle is whether it applies in a variety of situations and circumstances. So, for example, if you're against house burglary, you should not only be against someone burglarizing your home, but you should be against you perpetrating a burglary against someone else's home. It has to work both ways. Similarly, we need to ask, if the referendum result had been 52% Remain, 48% Brexit, would these petitioners have been supportive of a poll for another referendum using exactly the same rationale they've employed? And I think we all know the answer. However, I think the importance of a petition and its mischief is that it sets the scene for Remain politicians to commence the insidious campaign to encourage Parliament to either A, set aside the referendum results, or B, organise another referendum much closer to the actual point of exit, which is currently mooted as December 2018. Now, one of the first out of the gate was Labour Party MP David Lammy, exhorting Parliament to, in his words, end this madness and to vote to ignore the referendum result. There was an article in the Independent newspaper which highlighted a statement on Mr. Lammy's Twitter feed which said, "Wake up. We do not have to do this. We can stop this madness and bring this nightmare to an end through a vote in Parliament. Our sovereign Parliament needs to now vote on whether we should exit the EU." Mr. Lammy's words. Won't tell you what I think about Mr. Lammy. And a bit later, we had Count Dracula himself, Tony Blair, highlighting that it would take a long time for Britain to exit the EU, and that the referendum was not necessarily, in his words, the settled will of the British population. Now, in terms of leaving the EU, there's a legal process, And there's also what you might call a negotiating process. And a clear strategy of the Remain political elite is to want to stretch out the leaving process for as long as possible. So their hope is that in the sort of 2.5 years that it will take Britain to actually leave the EU, is that they probably even hope for the economy to have a complete crash. And then they can argue that this can only be halted by the EU staying in the EU and creating the conditions for market confidence and stability. So these people have all been crowing about the sort of the fall in the pound and these other things, which were obviously inevitable when Britain left the EU, and which should have surprised nobody. So in terms of leaving, the mechanism is the first and the legal stage of Britain leaving the EU is for the sitting Prime Minister, who's now Theresa May, to trigger what they call Article 50 of the EU Constitution. In layperson's terms, this is a bit like giving notice to quit. You know, if you're going to leave a property, give notice to quit to the landlord. Now, following this, there would be an agreed period to negotiate the actual exit, which would involve negotiations on trade, migration, freedom of movement of people, etc. So we now know, as you all probably now aware, that Cameron had being the snidey coward that he was and is, had said he wouldn't trigger Article 50, and that it'd be for the next Prime Minister to do it. Theresa May has come in. She says she's not going to trigger Article 50, and she was somebody who voted for Remain and was campaigning for Remain. She says she's not going to trigger it, and she won't do it until the end of 2016. So that puts leaving time, because they say it's about 2 years for the negotiating period. So that means the earliest date Britain can leave now is December 2018. And they do say a week is a long time in politics. So you can imagine all the mischief that these people who want to overturn the referendum result can get up to in 2.5 years. So we need to be clear that Brexit is still not yet assured. Although I'm going to give Theresa May her due, she made it very clear that she accepts a referendum result, and she's appointed a pro-Brexit minister, David Davis, who's going to lead on the exit process. He's the minister for Brexit. Now, in terms of the view of the political elite in Europe, I'll read you two quotes by Philip Schultz, who's president of the European Parliament. And he said, "The British have violated the rules of the EU. It was never the philosophy of the EU that it should be directed by the views of the crowd." The crowd are basically people like me and you, so-called ordinary people. And he also said, "If the British leave the EU, there will be demands for further escape referendums." And I think the word escape is the right word he's used, because it is about escaping from a prison. And I think these quotes just show you the contempt the EU elite have for the population of the member states. And as I said earlier, the fear that a British exit could lead to the unravelling of the EU. So briefly, we'll just touch briefly on Scotland, which is, as I've put it, is itching to join the Euro prison. And it seems that some people learn nothing from experience, and the Scottish people who voted strongly for Remain seem destined to eventually leave the UK and join the EU, if it still exists by then. Because remember, there was a Scottish referendum about whether they should leave the United Kingdom and become an independent country. And there was just at the end it tipped. It seemed like they might vote to leave, and then the fear mongering and the Scots lost their nerve and they voted to remain part of the UK. If they join the UK, they'll have to take on the euro as their currency. And if they take on the euro as their currency, they're going to find themselves subject to looting and economic rape like the pigs, which are Portugal, Italy, Greece and Spain. The euro is a prison. And in the euro, the European Central Bank can turn off the euro tap whenever it likes. See, when you've got your own currency, you can produce your own currency if you need to. I mean, for better or worse, like the United States and Britain does. When you're in the euro, the ECB, the European Central Bank, produces the euro. And if they turn off the tap for you, They can squeeze you and force you to do whatever they want. So, you can end up with the ECB enforcing bank occupation on EU member states, just like they have in Greece and other places. So the Scots really need to be careful what they're asking for, because they just might get it. And if you want to know what the danger signs are for the EU, the canary in the mine is Italy, which has got a number of insolvent banks that the Italian government wants to bail out. And if you want to know the warning signs for the global economy, watch out for Deutsche Bank, which looks very much like Lehman Brothers did leading up to the last economic crash. There's three, what they might call global banks, which have been highlighted as in serious distress, and which could, if either of them fall, could lead to a collapse in the world economy. And those three banks are Deutsche Bank, number one, the biggest threat, which has got an incredibly large derivatives book. It's got hundreds of trillions, yes, trillions of derivatives on its books. You've also got HSBC, and then you've got Credit Suisse. Those are the three global banks that, if they topple over, we could be into 2007-2008 territory again. Okay, as we get near to wrapping up, let's have a quick look at why the European Union countries won't cut off their trade noses to spite their faces. And what I mean by that is that there's been a lot of talk in the press, both during and after the referendum, from the Remain supporters about the importance of the UK's trade with other EU countries. But not so many references to the specifics of this trade relationship. So I'm just going to give you some details so you understand how this trade actually works. I did a quick internet search just to look at Britain's trading relationship with other EU countries. And I came across an article by Larry Elliott, the Guardian's economics editor, and it was headlined, UK trade deficit with EU hits new record. And it notes that the gap between exports and imports in the first 3 months of 2016 widened by 0.7 billion to nearly 24 billion. That's Britain's trade gap with the EU in the first 3 months of 2016. And it went on to say that Britain's trade deficit with other European Union countries is running at a record high level ahead of the referendum next month. The latest health check from the Office for National Statistics on goods coming in and going out of the UK revealed that the gap between exports and imports in the first 3 months of 2016 widened by 0.7 billion to 23.9 billion. Trade has become an issue in the referendum campaign, with the Leave camp saying that the size of the UK's deficit will encourage other EU countries to grant Britain continued access to the European single market in the end of a Brexit vote. So, the point, and which I think is a very valid point made by the Leave campaigners regarding the incentive for the EU countries to continue to grant the UK access to the European single market due to the size of this trade deficit, is well made and reinforced by the size of the UK trade deficit with Germany, which is the undisputed economic powerhouse of the EU, and also with other leading EU countries. And the following article provides you with the numbers. The article is entitled UK Deficit Widens as Brits Can't Get Enough of Those German Goods. And the article goes on to tell us the love affair between David Cameron and Angela Merkel might be souring, but as Brits can't get enough of German goods, But us Brits, sorry, can't get enough of German goods. So I'll just reread that. The love affair between David Cameron and Angela Merkel might be souring, but us Brits can't get enough of German goods. The UK has just recorded its largest ever trade deficit with Germany. Germany has long been our largest trading partner, both in terms of exports and imports. But between August and September, increased by £200 million, taking it to an all-time high of £4.9 billion. So, that was from way back in November 2014, and I'm sure the deficit's even bigger since then. So the article also highlights that the UK's top 10 import and export partners. And if you go into the article and you check out the figures, you'll see that the UK has a trade deficit with every one of its top import countries, except the Irish Republic, where it's about 600 odd million pound surplus. If you want to know why export-oriented Germany loves the euro, a currency it shares with many much weaker economies such as the PIGS, Portugal, Italy, Greece and Spain, you have to understand that the euro gives Germany an artificially weak currency, which makes its exports cheaper. And another article highlights the remarkable trading success of Germany. And it also highlights that Germany has not posted an annual goods trade deficit in any year since 1951. So they've had 65 years of trade surpluses, 65 successive years. The Statis, the Federal Statistics Office, reported Tuesday that the German foreign trade balance showed a surplus of 247.8 billion euros in 2015, which was the highest value ever recorded. It exceeded the previous year's peak of 213.6 billion euros. In 2013, the surplus of the foreign trade balance had been 197.6 billion euros. So I hope the foregoing three articles have highlighted to you just why there's no incentive and a very real disincentive for the EU member states to impose a punitive trade agreement with the UK if and when it exits the EU. As they say, follow the money and always ask the question, who benefits? And it's highly unlikely that Mercedes, Daimler-Benz and other German companies are going to be allowing their government to impose sanctions or punitive tariffs against the EU, which would lead to reprisals by the UK government and which would damage their sales to Britain, which is referred to as Treasure Island in the EU because of the high prices you can charge for goods and services. Okay. So to bring this mega newsletter to a conclusion, and for me to be able to go and lie down in the dark room, the conclusion is the killing of police in Dallas and also later on in Baton Rouge in Louisiana was an inevitable reaction to hundreds of years of state-sponsored or supported violence against Africans in the US. It was not a question of if, but when. The police violence won't stop and has not stopped. For example, there's been the killing of Alva Brazil, which you can see on YouTube, and if you go into the newsletter, you can find the link, in Houston, with video footage showing that he had his arms up at the time, contradicting the lies of the killer cop who said he was pointing the gun when shot. The YouTube video link also provides a comparison of the treatment of Mr. Brazil with a European man, Keith Swainson, who fired shots at police and yet was not shot and he was peacefully arrested despite continuing making threats to kill, and the police waited 7 hours to negotiate him going voluntarily into their custody even after he'd fired shotguns at them. Of course, there'll be no question of the white population as to whether they support the violence against Africans. President Obama won't describe these murders as despicable, the way in which he described the killings of the police officers in Dallas and Baton Rouge. And I just want to make the point for you all that President Obama has not been conscripted to white supremacy. He's a volunteer. Remember that. He's a volunteer. He wasn't conscripted. He's a volunteer. And for all those very silly Obamaholics who kept telling us, oh, he needs to get settled in his first term, then he'll do something for us. And then, oh, wait for the second term, then he'll do something for us. You look really silly now, as you see what I've always been telling you, that Obama was never there for us, was never going to do anything for us, and he's a servant, a volunteer of white supremacy. And all he's looking forward to now is those big $200,000 a speech fees he's going to get when he leaves the White House and he can get onto the gravy train like Bill Clinton, like George W. Bush, and like all these other corrupt presidents who serve injustice and large corporations and the economic rape of their populations and the murder of people around the world. He's a killer and a war criminal, just like the ones who preceded him. And all these people who've got racial self-esteem issues need to get over it. His brown skin means nothing in terms of his loyalty. He's a war criminal. Get over it and deal with it. And for all those silly people who are going to support Hillary Clinton on the basis that she's a woman, you're perhaps even more stupid than the ones who supported Obama, because you've seen that skin colour representationalism means nothing and gender representationalism means nothing either. She's a ghoul. She's even more evil than Obama. She's a war criminal, and she could actually literally bring about the end of the world, such as her desire for war. She's even more dangerous than Donald Trump, which is an amazing thing to say, but she is. And in a future edition, I'll give you some video links which just show her complete and utter corruption, the corruption in the Clinton Foundation, which is probably the biggest charitable fraud in world history, her warmongering, her threats to use first strike nuclear weapons against Russia and China, which would lead to the end of the world. So, where do we go? A choice between two evils. The hold your nose election between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton. One a narcissistic egomaniac, another a ghoulish war criminal. Well, over to you, brothers and sisters in America, to see if you're actually going to vote for either of these maniacs. So, that's the end of the newsletter. Just a little unscripted rant at the end. But if you like what we do, share the newsletter with sane Africans. And, check out blackfinancialfitness.com. It's there for you. I'd like to do more newsletters, but, time doesn't allow. Hope you're finding them interesting and the podcast as well. Give me your feedback. And until next time, stay sane, stay safe, be African, and work towards economic empowerment with other like-minded Africans, and keep on keeping on. Tendamwari. It's time to win.